I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. In the last 4 years, the Trump administration has rolled back 125 rules and regulations affecting all aspects of the environment, according to the Washington Post. That includes less oversight of industries that pollute, less protection for endangered species, and preventing implementation of Obama-era policies to reduce carbon emissions and the threat of climate change. And in what looks like the waning days of the Trump presidency, the administration is fast-tracking the deregulation of power plants and auctioning off permits for drilling and mining on federal land. President Trump withdrew the U.S. from the Paris Climate Accord, something that President-elect Biden said he would reverse on his first day in office. He also promised an ambitious plan to reduce CO2 emissions in electricity to zero by 2035. Well, today on Radio Times, we want to look at the environmental legacy of the Trump administration and the challenges facing the incoming Biden administration. And we have two guests who have joined us. Let me introduce them. Michael Mann is professor of atmospheric science, director of the Penn State Earth System Science Center, author of the forthcoming book, The New Climate War, The Fight to Take Back Our Planet. Michael Mann, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Yeah, thank you, Marty. Good to be with you.
Nice to have you with us. Also with us is Jody Freeman. She's professor of law, director of the Harvard Law School Environmental and Energy Law Program. She served in the White House as counselor for energy and climate change between 2009 and 2010. Jody Freeman, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Great to be here. Thank you.
Well, here's a big global question, and I'll put this first to you, Jody Freeman. What would you say is President Trump's most damaging environmental either decision or policy?
Well, I'm going to give you a surprising answer, which is three conservative justices on the Supreme Court and replacing a third of the federal judiciary. And I say that because the complexion of the judiciary really impacts efforts to regulate environmental protection and adopt greenhouse gas regulations as well. So it will be challenging for the Biden administration to shape their rules in a way that will make sure they don't meet with legal challenge. And I think that, in addition to all the things you listed, Marty, is going to be Trump's quite negative climate legacy.
How do you see the legacy, Michael Mann?
Yeah, so that's a really important point. And it's difficult to choose because there's so many damaging actions that the Trump administration has taken and so much damage that they've done just in 4 years. But you sort of alluded to one of the key measures, one of the key actions that Joe Biden can take, which is to reenter the Paris Agreement. Now, in terms of what that actually accomplishes from a carbon emission standpoint, not all that much. In fact, we're mostly on course to meeting our obligations under the Paris Agreement, even with a lack of leadership from the Trump administration because of what states have been doing, municipalities, et cetera. But what's important about Joe Biden signaling that is that it conveys to the rest of the world that the United States is ready to resume a position of leadership on this issue. That's something we had under the Obama administration, as you already discussed. The Trump administration dismantled so many of the advances on climate action that had been accomplished under the Obama administration. But the greatest damage that it has done is to international diplomacy. Polluters like China have eased off in some of the actions that they had been taking. When Trump said he was leaving the Paris Agreement, it really took the pressure off of other major emitters to, you know, to step up their game. And so what we're witnessing now is a new era of engagement, an opportunity for us once again to lead on this issue. And that's the most important thing, as far as I'm concerned, that Biden can be doing right now, is to signal to the rest of the world that we're serious about our obligations and then to make sure that we act on them.
Well, and Jody, picking up on what you were saying earlier about looking at the judiciary and the impact that it could have or will have or is having on environmental regulations, environmental laws, I know a number of these 125 rules and regulations did end up in court, and the court in some cases voted or ruled against the Trump administration and sometimes for the Trump administration. But can President-elect Biden, with the stroke of a pen, undo some of these rules and regulations?
Well, the way it works is that Biden would write an executive order or a presidential memo directing his agencies, like the Environmental Protection Agency and others, to look again at the rules that Trump has unraveled and consider whether, based on the science and based on the law, they ought to be strengthened again. So the action will come from the government, from the agencies, not directly from the White House, but the impetus for it would come from the White House, the direction, just like Michael said about joining the Paris Agreement again, announcing the U.S. will join, the president would be the initiator and could essentially signal that, you know, he's going to have his government adopt climate policy regardless of what Congress wants. The courts have treated the Trump rules, or the deregulatory rules, I should say, really in a way that tells you they were sloppily done. The record Trump has on his rules surviving is very poor. Scores of them have been struck down by the courts because of the legal support for them was weak, or because the scientific support for them was weak. In some cases, their own record went against them when they tried to unravel these rules. It turned out it was more costly to unravel them or more dangerous for public health to unravel them. So they have a pretty poor record. I think the Biden administration could come in and look at the climate rules for the power sector and for the transportation sector that would reduce greenhouse gases, and would make sure the records for doing that are solid. So I'm pretty confident that they would survive judicial review in the courts. But my point really is, you can't do something too expansive, too adventurous. You couldn't try to set up, say, a national cap and trade scheme using existing law without the court stepping in there and saying, this looks like it's an overreach.
You both mentioned the Paris Accord, the Paris Climate Accord. Michael Mann, if I can go back to you. This is a non-binding agreement. It's not a treaty. It's about voluntary emissions pledging from most all of the countries of the world. Of course, the U.S. is not a party to this agreement, along with a handful of other countries. But is the Paris Accord, is it that powerful a motivator?
Well, it is. And just to be clear, the United States right now is the only country that has not committed to the Paris Accord. Of course, that will all change now in a matter of weeks, as Biden has indicated that one of his first acts will be to re-enter the Paris Agreement. Again, you know, we were talking about, you know, the sort of the impact of policies, and sometimes it's more about the message that they send than the direct impact that they have. In the case of Paris, it doesn't get us the reductions in carbon emissions that we need. It gets us about halfway there. So it's really only sort of a you know, it's a structure. It is a starting point for us to build on. And what's going to be critical is that at the next conference of the parties, which happens next December, the United States plays not only a constructive but a leadership role in ratcheting up those commitments. Now, in terms of enforcement, you know, the enforcement mechanism is what's called name and shame. If you're a country that's not doing your due diligence, you're not meeting your obligations, you're not making good faith commitments, then you are a pariah in the international community, or at least that's the idea. And so it does seem to have been effective. Most countries, even if they won't meet their commitments, are going to come close. And so it's a good starting point, but we need to build substantially on it. If we're going to prevent truly catastrophic warming of the planet, more than a degree and a half Celsius, roughly 3 degrees Fahrenheit, we need to bring carbon emissions down by a factor of 2 within the next decade. Paris alone doesn't do that, but it does get us a foothold.
And I do want to pick up on that, but let me go back to something else, Jody Freeman. This has to do with the Environmental Protection Agency, the EPA, the Interior Department under the Trump administration. Scott Pruitt, Ryan Zinke, you know, left under a cloud, some really unethical actions on their behalf or on their part. Andrew Wheeler was a coal industry lobbyist. He now heads up the EPA. What about the future of these agencies?
Well, it's a great question because the agencies have been undermined systematically by the Trump administration. You know, the treatment of science was really shameful in the administration, not including the career staff who are experts in the normal rulemaking process, trying to stack science advisory boards with lobbyists and trying to disqualify academic scientists from those science advisory boards, moving career staff around to new positions just to sort of take them off their game and remove them from places of authority. You know, this sort of internal shenanigans that really isn't very visible to people, this is a way you can try to undermine the core capacity of government agencies. And so I think the Biden team is going to come in and try to restore the normal role of career staff, strengthen the authority of the scientists, and restore the place of science. All of that work is to be done in addition to just, you know, reversing all of the rules that have been unraveled. I did want to just add something on the Paris Agreement, which is that, you know, the great achievement of the Paris Agreement that people may not fully recognize is that it's the first international climate agreement that managed to involve all of the major economies of the world. So the developing economies were not committed to take significant actions under the Kyoto Protocol, the earlier climate agreement. So this one moves us forward in the sense that everybody is in, including China, including India, including Brazil, including the world's growing economies that will produce more of the emissions over time. And that creates a forum for negotiation among the actors that are going to be most responsible going forward. So I think that's an important point about Paris as a forum for engaging the entire world.
We're almost having a break here, but Michael Mann, I checked the Yale Climate Opinion Map. It's maybe a month or two old, but nonetheless, it seems the Biden administration is going to have the public on its side. 72% of adults think global warming is real. 57% of them believe it is human-caused. 86% support funding research in renewable energy. Does that give Biden something to build on?
It does, and he's got a real mandate here. He's going to win this election, by the way, by about the same percentage that Barack Obama won his re-election. And so he has an electoral mandate, but he specifically has a mandate on climate. He actually campaigned on the issue of climate action in a way that no president really has done in the past, making it quite central to his agenda. And so that gives him a mandate to lead on this issue. And as Jody alluded to, he's going to encounter some obstacles, right? An adverse Supreme Court that will threaten to reverse any truly bold actions. He's not going to be able to implement a plan of carbon pricing, for example. So at some point, we will need congressional action on climate. We will need a comprehensive climate legislation that will put a price on carbon, that will provide incentives for renewable energy beyond what the executive branch alone can do. Will we see that sort of environment? It actually depends entirely on what happens in these two special elections, these two upcoming special elections. If Democrats do manage to retake the Senate and Mitch McConnell is no longer the Senate majority leader, then there's a fundamentally different atmosphere for climate action. If McConnell retains power, then it's going to be a real challenge.
Well, we're going to take that short break, get back to our conversation with Michael Mann, Jody Freeman, and with you talking about the environmental legacy of the Trump administration and what's ahead for the Biden administration. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane. We're discussing Trump's environmental and climate legacy with Michael Mann. He's a professor, director of Penn State's Earth System Science Center, and Jody Freeman, director of the Environmental and Energy Law Program at Harvard University. You can join us as well. Any questions or comments, send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. 1-888-477-9499. President-elect Joe Biden has outlined a series of bold environmental policies, including getting back into the Paris Accord, zero CO2 emissions by 2035, and more. Here he is speaking in Wilmington, Delaware. It's July 14th. He's still the candidate for president. Joe Biden speaking about some of his plans for the environment.
We're going to lock in progress that no future president can roll back or undercut to take us backward again. Science requires a timetable for measuring progress on climate that isn't three decades or even two. Science tells us we have 9 years before the damage is irreversible. So my timetable results is in my first 4 years as president. The jobs we'll create, the investments we'll make, and the irreversible steps we'll take to mitigate and adapt to the climate change and put our nation on the road to net zero emissions no later than 2050.
And again, talking with Jody Freeman and Michael Mann, just picking up on that and actually going back to the Trump administration, I'll put this to you, Jody Freeman. The Trump administration says, look, we cleaned up Superfund sites. We upgraded city water systems. We helped to maintain our national park systems. They're saying this is part of our legacy. True? Not true?
Yeah, that sort of achievement is just wildly overwhelmed by the negative impact they've had, especially on climate change. It's not like anything else. We've lost 4 years of progress that, you know, you can't just make up quickly. We have to get back on the path to reducing emissions. And the trouble is that the United States Congress, as Michael pointed out, is really key to this. A new president can reverse the rules and put stronger measures in place, but we need to put a price on carbon. We need to make producing carbon expensive and unleash innovation in creating ways to reduce it. And the way to do that is to pass either a carbon tax or put a national cap on it and create a trading scheme to reduce the emissions using market mechanisms. There are many ways to do it, but Congress needs to be adopting a new law. And I have a little different perspective on the importance of the two Georgia runoffs. Even if the Democrats were to have control of the Congress, it's still going to be challenging to get a sweeping climate bill through. If the Democrats were to have control of Congress, it's really going to still be difficult to get a sweeping bill through. And the reason is that climate politics don't fully run on party lines. It depends on the region you come from and your resource endowment. If you're from a coal state or an oil state, you recall in the Obama years, we tried to pass a cap and trade bill called Waxman-Markey that would have put a national cap on carbon. And that managed to get through the House and not through the Senate. And we had both the House and the Senate at the time. So it's challenging, and you need a lot of political motivation, mobilization, even when Democrats are in charge. So I would be looking right now for smaller policies that are still going to put us on the right footing, like adopting, say, a national clean energy standard, something that Republicans and Democrats could support in a bipartisan way. There are opportunities for those kinds of things, and they can provide the first steps toward more sweeping legislation toward a price on carbon that we do need, but that may not happen right out of the gate.
Michael Mann, let me go back to you. And President-elect Biden has promised to reduce CO2 emissions in electricity to zero by 2035. Is that doable? And how would we do it?
It is certainly doable. And again, it's going to depend on what sort of policies we have in place. And it brings us back to this previous conversation. I wanted to follow up on what Jody just said. In fact, before the break, I was sort of wrapping things up quickly because I knew we were headed into a break, but I was going to make actually the same exact point. Even if Democrats do retain control of the Senate, it's going to be a split Senate. You have about four or five Democrats who actually joined with Republicans to vote on and vote down a Green New Deal. It was actually a caricature of the Green New Deal, and it was a symbolic effort by Republicans to basically signal that they wouldn't support ambitious climate policy. And four Democrats, fossil fuel-friendly Democrats, joined them. So what that means is that any meaningful climate legislation for the foreseeable future isn't going to be an aggressive, progressive, Green New Deal type expansive climate plan. It's going to have to involve some degree of collaboration, of crossover by at least a handful of Republicans. And as Jody alluded to, one way of doing that is by supporting market mechanisms. The Green New Deal, ironically, by and large rejects market mechanisms. It's perceived as problematic by sort of a sector of the environmental left. And yet, it probably is an essential tool in combating climate change. And there are conservatives who embrace the idea of, say, a carbon tax. Of course, there's some debate about what the magnitude of that tax would be and how progressive it would be. Conservatives tend to support revenue neutral. The conservatives who support carbon pricing often promote a revenue neutral carbon tax. So there's no increase in overall taxation, just a shifting of taxes. You'd reduce certain taxes and you levy a carbon tax. Look, there's a worthy conversation, debate to be had about that. And that's what we're going to need to see. We're going to need to see some degree of bipartisan compromise. That doesn't mean, you know, the entire Republican contingent is going to embrace climate policy, but there are probably a handful, four or five, who might be willing to do that if the political climate is right.
Well, and I wondered, Jody, picking up on what Micah was just saying there, I mean, there's the sort of political tax approach, but what about technology? I mean, how much can of new emerging technology can take us to zero carbon emissions by 2035, which, of course, is 15 years away?
Right. Technology is crucial, and we've made so much progress. You know, the price of both wind and solar have come down dramatically. Now there are some challenges integrating them into the electric power grid, which can be overcome or helped by new technologies. We need some major investments in infrastructure, green infrastructure, in advanced energy storage techniques, in batteries. Michael can speak to some of this, I'm sure, from a scientist's perspective. And sure. The good news here about that is the Biden plan is to make significant investments in these green or clean technologies, as they're called. And I am optimistic about this getting through Congress, because I think spending on green infrastructure, spending on new advanced technologies in the energy space, I think they're going to be very much part of a recovery package for COVID. And that's the kind of thing that could attract bipartisan support. You don't even need to care about climate change if you're a Republican or if you're a conservative Democrat to kind of be interested in spurring innovation and to make America more competitive in these domains and to create good jobs in this space. So that, I think, will be part of a package that will probably move fairly quickly after Biden is inaugurated. And that can be kind of a down payment on then taking some regulatory actions that will reduce emissions, and that will come from the executive branch. So even if we cannot get a sweeping bill from Congress, you can put these policies together: big investments in technology, regulatory standards for certain sectors like electric power and transportation coming from the agencies, and then you've got to find a way over time to get Congress to pass what we really need, which is a price on carbon.
You know, Michael Mann, I was looking at what various states have been doing, and it looks like Vermont gets almost all of its electricity from carbon zero sources. Is the action in Washington, D.C., or is the action on addressing the threat of climate change really happening at the state and local level? Not all of them, of course, but some of them.
Yeah. Well, look, you know, if Vermont served as a model for all of the states, we would have this problem solved. Obviously,
really?
There are certain states that have much more progressive policies on climate and the environment. And Vermont has shown real leadership. California has shown leadership. Oregon, Washington. There's a consortium. Actually, there are a couple consortia now of states, the West Coast states that have joined together in a regional consortium. The New England and Mid-Atlantic states, REGI, Pennsylvania, under the current Governor Wolf, joined REGI, is now part of this regional consortium. So about 30% of the American population lives in a state that is part of a consortium that already embraces, climate action, climate pricing, incentives for renewable energy. And so there's quite a bit of progress that can be made at the state level, at the municipal level. What companies in the United States that recognize that younger consumers reward green policies, and companies are moving in that direction. A number of our largest companies, when Trump said he was leaving the Paris Accord, immediately spoke up and said, you know, we're still in. We don't care what Trump does. Most of our largest companies actually were part of the We Are Still In pledge. And so it's good politics. Look, even young conservatives under the age of 30, overwhelmingly support action on climate. So I think even the Republican Party can see the writing on the wall. They recognize that younger voters are going to demand action on climate, and there's going to be a lot of pressure for them to move in the right direction. And so that's where, you know, as Jody has alluded to, there's some room for bipartisan compromise. One last thing, you know, when we're talking about what the executive branch can do on its own, a really interesting discussion, a group of prior Obama sort of cabinet folks helped put together a plan called Climate 21, which is sort of a blueprint for how Biden could move forward using, you know, executive actions alone. And one of the things they emphasize is, you know, look, even this, you know, every department in the government can play a role here. The State Department, obviously with respect to diplomacy, but interestingly, the Treasury Department. The Treasury Department, for example, could require companies and corporations to disclose climate risk to investors. And one of the very important trends here that we're not talking a lot about right now is the direction that the investment community, the finance community, the insurance community is moving. Increasingly, they see climate, you know, fossil fuel laden projects as a liability, and they're resisting funding those projects. A lot of the largest banks and hedge funds are pulling out of those sectors, and so there's this huge headwind even within the business community. And so all of this is coming together in a way that I think does create, you know, an opportunity, an atmosphere for progress, despite all of the challenges we've seen over the last 4 years, and despite the uphill challenge that we have now in averting catastrophic climate change. We need to decarbonize our economy very quickly.
Let me just quickly reintroduce both of our guests. That's Michael Mann. He's a professor of atmospheric science, director of the Penn State Earth System Science Center. Jody Freeman, a professor of law, director of the Harvard Law School Environmental and Energy Law Program. We're talking about the Trump administration's environmental legacy, talking about the challenges and opportunities facing President-elect Joe Biden. And you can join us, Radio Times at WHYY.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And you can call us. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Jody, let me ask you about, you know, when people talk about renewables, I mean, we're talking about, or clean energy, we think about renewables, you know, sun and wind and all of that. Do we include nuclear in that? Do we include biomass? Do we include hydropower? Do they have a role to play?
Yes. I mean, hydropower is, of course, you know, zero emission carbon. Of course, we aren't going to be building a lot of new dams in this country, so we're really maxing out hydropower. You know, states like Vermont that Michael alluded to and the Pacific Northwest use a lot of hydropower, which gives them a real advantage over states that don't have it as a resource. Nuclear power is 20% of our electricity mix, and it's a crucial component because it's zero carbon, but there's controversy over building new nuclear. So that's going to be a question going forward, is the American appetite for nuclear. But I want to go back to a couple things that Michael alluded to. You know, we were involved in Climate 21, the project that lays out all the things the executive branch can do. My program at Harvard was a partner in that and co-wrote the EPA part of that report. And we've also put up on my Harvard Law School Environment and Energy Program website an agenda for the Biden administration, the top priorities, the things that EPA and the Department of the Interior can do right away, the day one steps, et cetera. So we've got this quite expansive list. And there's a lot of activity over the federal government that can be done in the first year to year and a half, including this whole government approach that Michael talked about. What's important is to embed people with climate knowledge and sensitivity in the not usual suspect agencies, agencies you don't think about as being leaders on climate change. Think of the U.S. Department of Agriculture, the way that it conducts research over carbon sinks, using forestry practices, using agricultural practices to absorb carbon. The Treasury Department that Michael invoked with its ability to condition financing on climate disclosure. And the Department of Defense with its enormous power through procurement, right, to forest clean technologies through the supply chain. There are so many levers to pull in the federal government in places you don't normally think of. And the other place I just mentioned to look for inspiration and guidance is what the states are doing across the board on clean energy deployment. They're trying to support renewable technologies, as you mentioned, technologies that are so important to making this energy transition. And there are Republican states, not just Democratic-led states, that are leading the way on wind and on solar power and on converting their utilities from coal to renewables. Unlikely places you might not think about: Texas, Iowa, Arizona. So the states are demonstrating that there is Republican support for these things. And the question is, can we pull that into the Congress and get bipartisan support for some of these policies?
Let me put something out on the table, Michael, that is a very important issue in Pennsylvania, which is fracking. President-elect Biden said he is not opposed to fracking. He doesn't want it on federal land, but he's not preventing people with private land about having fracking on their piece of property. This is an issue, though, that has divided a lot of progressives and a lot of people within the Democratic Party. Again, we're almost up on a break here, but just quickly, how do you see fracking in, sorry, 30 seconds or less, and then we'll pick up on this after the break.
Yeah, look, you know, natural gas fracking is about natural gas. A fossil fuel can't be the solution to a problem created by fossil fuels. So it's not a bridge to a fossil fuel-free future. Too much emphasis has been placed on the fact that Biden didn't explicitly say that he would ban fracking. That's not the issue. Look at coal. There isn't a ban on coal, but it's in a death spiral because market forces are making it uncompetitive with other sources of energy. That's what we need to do with natural gas and all fossil fuels, create market incentives that price them out of the market. And Biden does embrace those sorts of measures to transition us away from fossil fuels, including natural gas, including fracking.
Let's take that break and we'll get back to our conversation. That's Michael Mann, Jody Freeman. We are talking a bit about the Trump environmental legacy, but looking ahead to the Biden administration. President-elect Joe Biden has offered a pretty ambitious program to deal with some of these environmental challenges. We're going to talk more after this very short break and we'll hear from some of our listeners. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Let me just recap what we're talking about. The Trump administration rolled back something like 125 environmental rules during its tenure, policies that protected wildlife and water, regulated chemicals and greenhouse gases. We're talking with our guests about some of the impact, the legacy of these decisions, and what actions President-elect Biden can take to address some of these environmental challenges, including climate change. Michael Mann, professor, director of Penn State's Earth Systems Science Center. Jody Freeman, director of the Environmental and Energy Law Program at Harvard University. And again, you can join us, Radio Times at WHYY.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us 1-888-477-9499. Let me get some of our listeners in on the conversation. We've got an email from Dick, and I'll put this to you, Jody Freeman. He says, what about Trump's claim that the accord, this would be the Paris Accord, gives China a long break before having to comply?
China's actually...
No, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Jody.
Oh, sorry.
That's all right.
Yeah, I think that actually China's been making some ambitious claims about the progress that it can make. It's exceeded its original Paris Agreement commitment that it made when it joined back in 2015. It's actually on the path to doing better. So I'm not sure that that we should criticize China when we've actually withdrawn. The best way for us to influence other countries, the best ways for us to leverage action from them is to show and demonstrate our own domestic policy commitment. And that was actually the Obama administration's plan. And that's why President Obama worked with President Xi to sort of be the two leaders getting the Paris Agreement across the line. We won't have as much opportunity to influence the direction of China or India or other countries unless we're in the agreement again. So I would say we need to get back at the table, get back into a leadership position. And I would add to that that if we plan to work with China on this issue, it will help us in our other relationship with China, right? The climate and energy negotiations were a bright spot in the Obama administration. We struck some side deals, and in our bilateral negotiations with China, energy and climate was always a point of progress. So it helps us deal with trade and the other much more volatile kinds of discussions we have to have something to work with them on, and that is climate and energy policy.
Let me read an email from Mike, and I'll read one from Fred as well. Mike says, the interesting thing about the Yale map is how closely the level of climate concern reflects political leaning. Those parts of the country which are most concerned about climate change tend to be the coastal states, large cities, and large universities. Those parts that are least concerned tend to be in the center of the country, i.e. more conservative. The challenge for the Biden administration will be to convince half the country that climate change must be dealt with. Here's an email from Fred. I'll put this to you, Michael Mann. He says, because the greenhouse gases, CO2, remain in the atmosphere for hundreds of years, why would we not have runaway warming? And it seems, you know, dealing with climate change is, you know, is the big challenge facing all of us, the entire planet.
Yeah, so a great question from Fred. And, you know, our understanding of that problem has evolved over the last decade and a half. We used to think that there was a substantial climate commitment. If we stop emitting carbon right now, that just the CO2 we've already put into the atmosphere would continue to warm up the oceans for not just decades, but potentially centuries into the future. And that's true, but as we have become more sophisticated in how we go about these experiments, we don't just think of CO2, carbon dioxide, as a dial in the climate model that you turn up, because that's not the way it works. We put carbon dioxide into the atmosphere when we burn fossil fuels, and the climate system itself, the Earth system, takes up some of that carbon. The ocean absorbs some of it. The land absorbs some of it, plants on land, animals. And so there is what we call a global carbon cycle. And when we model that explicitly, what we find out is that if we stop emitting carbon right now, then yes, the carbon that's in the atmosphere continues to warm the surface of the planet, but the ocean is taking up that carbon. It's taking carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere, and it's no longer building up because we're not burning fossil fuels. And those two effects, the committed warming and the uptake of carbon by the ocean, largely cancel out. And so what we're left with is how much warming we have to deal with is a function of cumulative emissions up to now. That's really important. It gives us great agency. If we stop burning carbon now, the surface of the planet within a few years stops warming up. It's why we can talk about a climate budget. It's why we can specify how much carbon we can burn and remain below, say, 1.5 degrees Celsius, because the Earth system works that way. So it's a little bit of good news. It means that our actions now have an immediate impact.
Michael, just a quick follow-up to that, but the hurricane season continues. I think we've gone all the way through the alphabet, and now we're starting a whole new alphabet. I'm thinking of the fires out west and other parts of the world. I'm thinking of droughts, the heat. Is that all? Can we say now, without any doubt, that all of that is related to the warming planet?
Oh, it is. I mean, there's no serious debate about whether the unprecedented extreme weather events that we are now seeing around the world, the wildfires out west here, the bushfires down in Australia, unprecedented heat waves and droughts and floods. The climate physics is pretty clear. Those unprecedented events, those extreme events, are being favored We wouldn't be seeing such extreme and damaging weather events in the absence of the warming of the planet. And so, yes, to some extent, we're stuck with a certain amount of dangerous climate change. People sometimes ask, what's the warming level where we get into dangerous climate change? We're already there, right? If you're, you know, California or Colorado with the wildfires they've experienced, if you're the Gulf Coast, which has been pounded by an unprecedented hurricane season this year, if you're Puerto Rico, that was decimated by a landfalling Category 5 storm a few years ago, North Carolina, the flooding from Hurricane Florence, Houston, the flooding from Hurricane Harvey. For all of those places, dangerous climate change has already arrived, and it's a matter at this point of how bad we're willing to let it get. So I like to frame it in this way. There is great urgency in acting now, but there is also agency. We can make a difference by acting now.
Jody, there's something we haven't talked about. It's very important. It's something I know that President-elect Biden has talked about, which is environmental justice and the fact that oftentimes communities of color bear the brunt, whether it's health risks or environmental risks because of chemical plants and energy plants that are in their neighborhood. What can we do about that?
Yes, just hugely important topic. And you have to give some credit to the Green New Deal on this for bringing together the demand for social justice with the demand for doing something on climate change so that now we see them as necessarily connected. And that is, we can't adopt climate policies or environmental policies that disproportionately burden minority communities or black and brown communities. This has been a longstanding problem in environmental law. You know, there have been studies that show that we have cited toxic waste dumps disproportionately in low-income communities, and they've been burdened with poor drinking water and a variety of other harms. And the Biden plan calls for putting environmental justice central to any policies that they adopt and making sure that revenue raised from any of these policies, let's say we, you know, price carbon and we create a cap and dividend program, that that goes back to minority communities in significant share. So I see this issue now as much more central, and appropriately so. And I think what you'll see is the agencies looking at how these rules or regulations about climate and energy policy have impacts on low-income communities and factoring that into decision-making in a much more pronounced way, making that a priority. This president has done more to make that a priority on the campaign trail than anyone else, and it's appropriate given the cry for social justice at the moment. And I think that you can probably look forward to seeing this much more prominently in this administration than any administration before.
That is really good news. Michael, let me ask you about weatherizing homes and commercial buildings. That's, again, something else that the Biden administration wants to do. How effective is that in reducing some of the climate emissions that we're dealing with?
Yeah, well, it's part of, you know, the larger sort of category of efficiency. And, you know, if you look at plans to decarbonizing our economy, viable plans like the Climate Solutions Project, spearheaded by Mark Jacobson of Stanford, and they've looked at every state and what measures would be necessary to decarbonize the economies of those states. And the mix, you know, as, you know, the mix of solutions, as we already heard from Jody, is going to vary depending on the state. But if you look at a state like California, which has done such a good job in growing its economy while decarbonizing its economy, a lot of the progress, the success that they've had, has been from efficiency measures, using less energy, wasting less energy. So that's part of the solution. Efficiency is part of it, and getting away from fossil fuels. Renewable energy is part of it. There's no magic bullet. These are all components of any comprehensive policy to get us off of carbon and to avert catastrophic climate change.
Jody, here's an email from Cynthia. How difficult is it to convert existing internal combustion engines to electric engines? It seems that it may help us transition from fossil fuels, especially for folks with limited ability to purchase a new electric car. It could be a great jobs program. And just picking up on that, in terms of looking at the automobile, I mean, it's hard to imagine a world without automobiles, but nonetheless, is the future in electric cars?
Yeah, I don't think we have to imagine a world without automobiles, thankfully. But, you know, it's a fundamentally different technology to electrify the vehicle fleet because you're relying on batteries. And in fact, you open up your hood, there is no engine. And so the mechanism is entirely different, or the technology is entirely different. And, you know, I think we're headed toward electrification. I think when people realize that they don't have to have range anxiety, you know, worrying about how far they can drive their car. As these things start to penetrate the economy and you see more people buying them, you'll see more comfort with these kinds of vehicles. But even our traditional vehicles have gotten, traditional internal combustion engines have gotten and are getting more and more efficient. And that's because of fuel efficiency standards. And so that's a terribly important policy that the federal government needs to put in place. The market isn't really with us in this transportation sector right now. The oil prices are so low, that gasoline prices are so low, that people aren't worried about buying gas, and so they're not really incentivized to buy more fuel efficient cars. That's different than the electric power sector, where the market's with us because cheap natural gas has displaced coal. So that sector is moving in the cleaner direction. The transport sector, unfortunately, is not. And there are not ready substitutes for gasoline. So electrification might be the answer, efficient electrification, as the question posed. And I think that's coming. That's the wave of the future. A lot of the vehicles sold now, and California's now put a mandate that new cars sold will be electric vehicles in the future. And I think that that's the direction we're headed in. But you need the federal government to play its part there, because only federal fuel efficiency standards are going to help push that policy through.
Michael, I'm curious about looking at either cabinet picks or who's going to head up specific environmental or interior department agencies. Are there certain names you'll be looking for that will tell all of us that the Biden administration is moving in the direction that the two of you have been talking about?
Yeah, let me first comment on something Jody just said, because it's really important. You know, a big part of the solution here is electrification. That's part of it, right? But, you know, electrification of vehicles, you know, if your electricity is coming from fossil fuels, it doesn't help you. It helps you a little bit, but what you really need to do is to decarbonize at the same time the power sector. And, you know, market forces, as Jody said, aren't necessarily aligned in that direction right now when it comes to the transportation sector. That's part of the reason that we need to put a price on carbon, level the playing field so that, you know, non-carbon producing energy can compete fairly against, you know, fossil fuel energy that's damaging the climate, that's damaging the planet. And so we need incentives that assist, you know, the market in moving in the right direction, in addition to regulations restoring the sorts of fuel efficiency standards that we had under the Obama administration, for example. All of these things are important and they work together. So in terms of the cabinet, I'm not going to name names because that's always a dangerous game.
It is.
But what I would like to see, you know, and as Jody already alluded to, I'm going to look at the picks for all of the administrations, because we need people who understand the climate crisis and are willing to do what they can to address it in all of the various departments and agencies. So I'm going to be looking at Interior. I'm going to be looking at State Department. I'm going to be looking at Treasury Department. Not just the usual suspects, Department of Energy and Environmental Protection Agency. We have to take a much more expansive view of what climate action will mean under this administration. And I want to see, you know, there is a climate czar who will be named. I want to see people in those positions who have a record of recognizing and addressing the climate crisis and don't necessarily, you know, for example, support a fossil fuel intensive transition. And there are some individuals whose names have been mentioned as potential, you know, who have been floated as potential administration picks have a record of sort of coddling the fossil fuel industry and not supporting the bold actions that we've talked about that are necessary to decarbonize our economy. So I'm going to be looking to make sure that we don't get, you know, fossil fuel friendly individuals who talk a good game but don't walk the walk. in those positions that we're talking about. I want to see a real commitment to climate action.
Well, and I'd love to hear your answer, Jody, as well, but we are out of time. My thanks to both of you. Thank you very much for joining us today in Radio Times. Jody Freeman, Professor of Law, Director of the Harvard Law School Environmental and Energy Law Program. Thanks for joining us on Radio Times.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And Michael Mann, Professor of Atmospheric Science, Director of the Penn State Earth System Science Center, author of the forthcoming book out next year, The New Climate War, The Fight to Take Back Our Planet. And we appreciate all those comments to Radio Times as well. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Aronson, Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thanks for joining us.